Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Now, make no mistake, anyone who votes to reverse this rule is saying loud and clear that they stand with the banks instead of their constituents, because bank lobbyists are the only people asking Congress to reverse this rule.
After 9 months of struggling to deliver on their legislative priorities, Senate Republicans found unity in overturning a rule that makes it easier for Americans to sue banks and credit card companies. We'll get an update from Public Citizen's Amanda Werner, who's recently been seen dressed as Rich Uncle Pennybags with a top hat and monocle, sitting directly behind former Equifax CEO Richard Smith when he testified about a security breach that left sensitive personal information for 143 million Americans exposed to hackers. Then a major decision by the Federal Communications Commission eliminates a decades-old rule that ensures community residents have a say in their local broadcast TV station. This comes as the FCC announces plans to abolish longstanding media ownership rules.
If you believe, as I do, that the federal government has no business intervening in the news, then we must stop the federal government from intervening in the news business. And that is why this afternoon I shared with my fellow commissioners an order that will reform our media ownership rules and help pull the government once and for all out of the newsroom.
Opponents say the change will allow companies like the right-wing Sinclair Broadcast Group to buy up and control even more local stations. We'll speak with Mother Jones' Andy Kroll, whose news story is headlined Ready for Trump TV, Inside Sinclair Broadcasting's Plot to Take Over Your Local News. Then, despite the Trump administration's efforts to block it, an undocumented teenager in detention gets the abortion she sought. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Questions are mounting about the relationship between the massive private prison contractor GEO Group and the Trump administration. The Washington Post has revealed GEO Group held its annual leadership conference last week at President Trump's private Miami-area golf resort, the Trump National Doral. GEO Group was also a major backer of the Trump campaign, giving $225,000 to a pro-Trump super PAC and then another $250,000 to Trump's inaugural committee. The company then secured a new multi-million-dollar contract from the Trump administration. Its stock price has tripled since last year when the Obama administration announced efforts to end the use of private prisons. USA Today is reporting the Trump administration is slated to declare the opioid crisis a public health emergency. The order would allow states to shift federal funds to address the opioid crisis, which killed 64,000 Americans last year. To see our full interview about the Sackler family, the secretive family that has made billions off the opioid crisis, you can go to democracynow.org. The Washington Post is reporting the establishment Republican Party has declared open warfare on President Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Bannon is the head of the far-right news outlet Breitbart News, which has been described as an online haven for white nationalists. He's also the leading figure in the insurgent far-right of the Republican Party. The establishment wing of the Republicans, led by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, has now formed a super PAC called the Senate Leadership Fund ahead of the 2018 congressional elections with the aim of specifically attacking and discrediting Bannon. In more news from Capitol Hill, Senate Chaplain Barry Black indirectly called upon more lawmakers to speak out against President Trump during his prayer before the Senate morning session on Wednesday.
Lord, we praise you for ethically congruent lawmakers who in their inmost beings are true and honest. Give us more senators who are true to duty as the needle to the pole. Give us more legislators who are not afraid to call sin by its right name.
The chaplain's prayer comes after two prominent Republican lawmakers, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake and Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, slammed President Trump Tuesday, with Flake calling Trump's behavior reckless, outrageous, and undignified, and Corker saying Trump's lying and bullying is debasing to our country. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange says he refused a request to help from a data firm linked to President Trump ahead of the 2016 presidential election. The Daily Beast is reporting the head of Cambridge Analytica reached out to Assange about potentially working with WikiLeaks to release some of Hillary Clinton's emails. Cambridge Analytica worked for Trump during the final months of the campaign. On Wednesday, Assange said he rejected the idea of working with the firm. In Kenya, voters are heading to the polls for a rerun of the contested presidential election between the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and opposition leader Raila Odinga. Odinga's boycotting the rerun after his demands for changes in the electoral process were not met. The Supreme Court overturned the results of the first election in August, citing mismanagement by the Electoral Commission. In Tanzania, journalists are demanding President John Magufuli overturn a 90-day ban on the popular daily newspaper, the Tanzania Daima. It's the fourth newspaper to be shut down in recent months, and its shutdown comes amidst a mounting crackdown against the free press in Tanzania. In Brazil, President Michel Temer has narrowly avoided being put on trial for corruption. Temer and his associates have been accused of pocketing nearly $200 million in bribes and covering up their crimes. On Wednesday, Brazil's lower house of Congress voted not to try the president, even though a secretly recorded tape captures him approving hush money payoffs for a powerful politician jailed on corruption charges. Temer has pushed right-wing and neoliberal policies that are deeply unpopular, and he currently has an approval rating of about 3%. In Indonesia, dozens of people have been killed in an explosion at a firecracker factory outside the capital, Jakarta. The Thursday morning fire has killed at least 47 people so far, with the death toll expected to rise. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley cut short her visit to South Sudan after hundreds of people protested against the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir at Haley's event. Her departure came after Haley said the U.S. has lost trust in Kiir's government, which the U.S. has supported since South Sudan's independence in 2011.
We're disappointed by what we're seeing. This isn't what we thought we were investing in. What we thought we were investing in is a free, fair society where people could be safe. And South Sudan is the opposite of that.
The United Nations warns an ethnic cleansing campaign carried out by the South Sudanese government has killed thousands of civilians, triggering a massive refugee crisis. In Pakistan, officials say multiple U.S. drone strikes along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border killed more than two dozen people last week. Officials told Reuters four unmanned drones fired six missiles on October 16th, killing up to 20 people. The same official said another round of strikes the following day killed another 11 people. Puerto Rico's federally imposed financial oversight board is planning to install an emergency manager to take control of the daily operations of Puerto Rico's Electric Power Authority. On Wednesday, the board said it plans to appoint retired Air Force Colonel Noel Zama to run Puerto Rico's power company, which is currently the largest publicly owned power utility in the United States. This comes after revelations that the tiny Montana firm Whitefish Energy won a $300 million contract to rebuild the grid. Whitefish Energy is linked to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The company is backed by the private equity firm HBC Investments, whose founder was a Trump campaign donor. The NAACP has issued an advisory warning black passengers about a pattern of racist incidents on American Airlines. The NAACP cites multiple instances in which African-American women were removed from flights or switched from first class to coach. It also cites an instance in which an African-American man was forced off a flight for responding to the racist comments of fellow white passengers. The NAACP says these events, quote, suggest a corporate culture of racial insensitivity and possible racial bias on the part of American Airlines, unquote. American Airlines says it does not tolerate discrimination. Former President George H.W. Bush has apologized for repeatedly groping women after being accused of sexual assault by two actresses. Actress Heather Lynn said when she met the president in 2014, quote, "He touched me from behind from his wheelchair. He told me a dirty joke, then all the while being photographed, touch me again." Actress Jordana Grolnick then also accused the former president of groping her during a photo in 2016, saying, quote, "He reached his right hand around to my behind, and as we smiled for the photo, he asked the group, 'Do you want to know who my favorite magician is?' As I felt his hand dig into my flesh, he said, 'David Copperfield,'" unquote. In response to the accusations, Bush's spokesperson said, quote, "To try to put people at ease, the president routinely tells the same joke, and on occasion, he's patted women's rears in what he intended to be a good-natured manner. Some have seen it as innocent. Others clearly view it as inappropriate. To anyone he has offended, President Bush apologizes most sincerely," unquote. NBC's senior political analyst, journalist Mark Halperin, has announced he's stepping back from his job after five women accused him of sexually harassing them when he was ABC's top political journalist. Meanwhile, the publisher of Art Forum magazine has resigned after nine women sued him for sexual harassment. Knight Landsman served as Art Forum's publisher for more than 30 years and was a major player in the international art world. Following the revelations, Art Forum's editor-in-chief also resigned. In recent days, a slew of men have resigned or been blacklisted in the wake of sexual harassment accusations, including high-profile photographer Terry Richardson, celebrity chef John Besh, influential tech industry figure Robert Scoble, and Amazon Studios programming chief Roy Price. All this comes after dozens of women came forward to accuse now-disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment, assault, and rape, ending the career of one of Hollywood's most powerful men. Then, the long-awaited JFK assassination files. The federal government will begin releasing the final cache of secret documents about the 1963 assassination of former President John F. Kennedy. Historians say the secret CIA and FBI files could also reveal details about U.S. attempts to assassinate the late Cuban President Fidel Castro. The undocumented teenager whom the Trump administration attempted to prevent from having an abortion has finally obtained the procedure after having to fight the federal government for a month. The 17-year-old, known as Jane Doe, is detained in a refugee resettlement shelter. She had the abortion Wednesday after a U.S. appeals court ruled in her favor. We'll have more on her case later in the broadcast. And rock and roll star Fats Domino has died at the age of 89. The Creole-French musician was born in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward in 1928. He taught himself piano and became part of a group of black musicians in New Orleans who pioneered the rhythm and blues style that became the foundation of rock and roll. Throughout the 50s and 60s, Fats Domino sold 65 million singles, making him one of the most popular artists in the world. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986 and won a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award the following year. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, Fats Domino refused to leave his beloved hometown. He was rescued from the floodwaters by family members. This is Fats Domino performing one of his most famous hits, "Ain't That a Shame."
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame?
Fats Domino died Tuesday at his home in Harvey, Louisiana, just across the Mississippi River from New Orleans at the age of 89. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. After 9 months of struggling to deliver on their legislative priorities, Senate Republicans found unity this week when they overturned a rule that would have made it easier for Americans to sue banks and credit card companies. The measure passed with Vice President Mike Pence breaking a 50-50 tie. This is Senator Sherrod Brown speaking just before the vote Tuesday night.
The Vice President of the United States is here. It looks like Equifax and Wall Street and Wells Fargo will win again. The vice president only shows up in this body when the rich and the powerful need him.
Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and John Kennedy of Louisiana broke with their party to vote against the measure, which now heads to President Trump, who's expected to sign it. The rule, developed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, would have allowed people to file class action lawsuits that could have cost the banks billions of dollars. It was set to go into effect next year. Senator Elizabeth Warren said Tuesday the vote represented, quote, a giant wet kiss to Wall Street.
Millions of Americans of all political parties think the game in Washington is rigged against them. And this vote is Exhibit A. Companies like Equifax and Wells Fargo have hurt millions of consumers and then turn around and try to escape accountability using forced arbitration clauses. The Republican Congress hasn't done a thing to help the people hurt by Wells Fargo. The Republican Congress hasn't done a thing to help the people hurt by Equifax. Nope. Instead, tonight, they are actually taking away one of your few legal tools to hold companies like Wells Fargo and Equifax accountable. This is shameful.
Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Amanda Werner, arbitration campaign manager for Public Citizen and Americans for Financial Reform. Amanda's also dressed as rich uncle Pennybags with a top hat and monocle and sat directly behind former Equifax CEO Richard Smith during a recent Senate hearing when he testified about a security breach that left sensitive personal information for 143 million Americans exposed to hackers. Amanda Werner, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what exactly they did, the Senate did, on Tuesday night that required, as all the social media is ablaze, under cover of night, Vice President Trump to break a tie vote.
So, unfortunately, on Tuesday night, Republicans voted to take away our right to sue banks like Wells Fargo, companies like Equifax, when they break the law. And they did this by repealing a new CFPB rule that restored our right to join together in class action lawsuits.
And could you talk more about the CFPB rule, what exactly it restrained companies from doing?
So it ended the use of what we call ripoff clauses. It's essentially these fine print clauses that they stick in, you know, take it or leave it contracts that say when they break the law and we have a dispute with them, instead of going to court or joining with other consumers who are similarly harmed, we have to go into secret arbitration. And in these secret arbitration proceedings, the bank or lender gets to pick a firm to decide the case, a firm that they work with routinely and has, you know, kind of this repeat player bias in their favor. And we are actually blocked from presenting evidence, from appealing a bad decision. There aren't the same kind of legal protections we get. And in fact, a recent Economic Policy Institute report found that the average consumer is forced to pay their bank or lender almost $8,000 in arbitration.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren said Republicans' vote on Tuesday makes it easier, as you said, for financial institutions to cheat people.
The banks and their lobbyists have actually got the gall to claim that they want to kill the rule because it's bad for their customers. You know, that claim is just plain laughable. According to a rigorous three-year-long CFPB study, consumers recovered an average of $540 million annually from class action settlements, while they received less than $1 million annually in the arbitration cases that the agency reviewed. It's not even close.
So can you explain exactly what Elizabeth Warren is saying? And also, the fact that this rule had just gone into effect a few weeks ago, that they have now just gotten rid of.
Yeah, I think that's what's really appalling here, is we actually had these rights restored after, you know, decades at this point of banks and lenders doing this to cover up their misconduct and to stop us from being able to get our money back when they rip us off. And now they've taken it away again. It's, you know, it feels like healthcare all over again, except this time it actually passed. So I think what Senator Warren is saying there is that class action lawsuits, especially in the financial context, are essential for holding these banks accountable. As we saw with Wells Fargo, they opened up 3.5 million fake accounts. if those consumers, if those millions of consumers who were harmed can't join together in one lawsuit, it just means that Wells Fargo doesn't actually have to pay any of that money back and never has to pay for those crimes.
Well, could you explain, Amanda, what forced arbitration is and how it constrains people who want to hold financial institutions to account?
Yeah, so it's a secret process with a biased decision maker that the bank picks. And essentially, it means that, you know, we can't, we have to go one by one instead of joining together at a class action when we've all been similarly harmed. So let's take Equifax. With the data breach, 145 million Americans' personal information was exposed to hackers. And under this rule, those 145 million Americans would have to file separate arbitrations. As you can imagine, there aren't enough arbitrators in the world to handle that. So that just means that Equifax is not going to be able to be held accountable at all. They're not going to see any lawsuits if they don't see a class action.
So can you talk about what you did when the Equifax CEO was testifying, Amanda?
Yeah. So, you know, we saw an opportunity for creative protest here. This is an issue that has been hard to, you know, get people to wrap their minds around and really care about because it is so legalistic in a lot of ways. So we decided to, you know, get creative. I dressed up as the Monopoly Man. We chose that imagery because we see this bill as a get out of jail free card for Equifax and Wells Fargo. So I got in full costume. I was in a tuxedo. I had a big red bow tie, a top hat, a monocle. And I sat right behind Richard Smith on the C-SPAN cameras. And essentially throughout his entire 2 hours of testimony, I was just mugging it for the cameras, making silly faces, twirling my mustache, fussing with my monocle. And the reason for that was just to make it more entertaining for folks, make sure that folks were paying attention, because this is one of the most important hearings we've seen in the Senate this year.
Let's go to a clip of Senator John Kennedy questioning former Equifax CEO Richard Smith, in which we can see you, rich uncle Pennybags, behind Smith.
You have my data, which you haven't paid me for. You're earning a good living, which I don't deny you. I believe in free enterprise. I think this is a very clever business model you've come up with. But you're earning your money by selling my data, which you get from me and don't pay me for, to other people. But if the data is wrong that you have about me, I would think you would want to make it as easy as possible to correct it, not as hard as possible.
I understand your point, and it's an important point for the entire industry to make the process as consumer-friendly as possible.
Still go to it. So if you can respond to that, Amanda Werner, and talk about how, more specifically, how Equifax will be benefited by the striking of the rule that Pence was needed, the vice president, to break the tie vote.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that frustrated people most about the Equifax data breach was that the day after they announced it, they, you know, put up this website where they were offering supposedly free credit monitoring as a way to make up for the data breach. But buried in the terms and conditions of that website was a forced arbitration clause. And people were just completely outraged that they would have taken advantage of this tragedy that they created to take away our right to sue them in court. What really struck us as consumer advocates about that moment, though, is that this is standard procedure. It wasn't just Equifax trying to get away with something in the wake of the data breach. This is what all banks and lenders do all the time.
Well, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told NBC News this rule would, quote, harm our community banks and credit unions by opening the door to frivolous lawsuits by special interest lawyers. So, Amanda, can you comment on what she said and, of course, the fact that Trump supports this? And you yourself were affected by the data breach, Equifax's data breach. So could you talk more about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the biggest talking points we see on this is trying to use community banks and credit unions as a shield for these big companies that will actually benefit. The fact is, community banks and credit unions, by and large, do not use these clauses at all. In fact, we have an email from one of the heads of one of these credit union associations that actually admits that their members do not use forced arbitration. So I don't see why they would have a dog in this fight. In fact, the smaller banks and credit unions will actually benefit by finally having a level playing field where they can compete with banks like Wells Fargo, who are using these arbitration clauses not only to get away with breaking the law, but in fact pad their profits when they steal from millions of consumers. You know, I think in the Equifax data breach, it affected so many people. It was about three quarters of the adult population. So I was affected. My friends were affected. I don't really know anyone who wasn't affected, to be quite honest. And we're not going to be able to do anything about that now that we can't come together in a class action. And unfortunately, we're going to need to see congressional action. But as we've seen, Congress can only get it together when they want to take away our rights, not when they want to do anything useful.
Last question, Amanda. That Tuesday night, you had some interesting outfits, not just the kind of outfits you wear, like Uncle Pennybags, when you're protesting the wealthy in Washington. But among the people who were on the floor was Senator Tom Cotton in a full tuxedo, because this was a night vote, and he was at an American Enterprise Institute a gala. Can you talk about what it looked like on the floor?
It was appalling. I mean, the fact that they would, you know, put on these tuxedos, go to fundraising events for their conservative donors the same night that they're taking away our right to get our money back when banks rip us off is just shameful. And frankly, I think it really shows why my Monopoly Man stunt resonated with so many people. It wasn't just drawing attention to the get out of jail free card. It was also just channeling this populist anger toward the billionaires who are trampling our rights this year and really taking our country away from us. I think it showed how out of touch all these politicians are. They're only accountable to their corporate donors. They do not care about the people.
Senator Cotton was the main sponsor of that bill. Amanda Werner, I want to thank you for being with us, arbitration campaign manager for Public Citizen and Americans for Financial Reform. Again, Amanda has also dressed as rich Uncle Pennybags, if you're walking around Congress, with a top hat and a monocle. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at Sinclair Broadcasting and then the story of the undocumented teenager who is in detention, prevailing over the Trump administration and getting an abortion this week. Stay with us. Domino, who died on Tuesday at his home in Harvey, Louisiana, just across the Mississippi from New Orleans, at the age of 89. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to a major decision by the Federal Communications Commission that eliminates a decades-old rule that ensures community residents can have a say in their local broadcast TV station. The regulation is known as the Main Studio Rule, and it requires broadcasters to have a physical studio near where they have a license to transmit. This comes as the FCC also announced plans at a hearing Wednesday to abolish long-standing media ownership rules, including limits on how many stations or newspapers one company can own in a single market. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai testified Wednesday during a congressional hearing.
"For if you believe, as I do, that the federal government has no business intervening in the news, then we must stop the federal government from intervening in the news business. And that is why this afternoon I shared with my fellow commissioners an order that will reform our media ownership rules and help pull the government once and for all out of the newsroom. We will vote on this order at our November 16th meeting. The marketplace today is nothing like it was in 1975. Newspapers are shutting down. Many radio and TV stations are struggling, especially in smaller and rural markets. Online competition for the collection and distribution of news is even greater than it ever was. And just two internet companies claim 100% of recent online advertising growth. Indeed, their digital ad revenue alone this year will be greater than the market cap of the entire broadcasting industry. And yet the FCC's rules still presume that the market is defined entirely by pulp and rabbit ears.
But opponents say these changes will accelerate media consolidation, allowing massive corporate media companies such as right-wing Sinclair Broadcast Group to buy up and control even more local stations. Earlier this year, Trump's FCC appointees revived a regulatory loophole that could allow Sinclair to buy 42 TV stations from Tribune Media Company on top of the more than 170 stations it already owns. The deal means Sinclair stations would reach about 72%, almost three-quarters of U.S. households. This comes as former Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly has reportedly been negotiating for a position with Sinclair Broadcast Group. O'Reilly secretly settled a sexual harassment claim for $32 million in January, the sixth and by far the largest such settlement during his tenure at Fox, from which he was fired. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Andy Kroll, senior reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, where he's written extensively about the FCC. His latest story in the current issue is headlined, "Ready for Trump TV? Inside Sinclair Broadcasting's Plot to Take Over Your Local News." Andy, welcome back to Democracy Now! You know, a lot of the meme going around is that Trump just can't get anything done. But it sure doesn't look that way at the FCC this week. Can you talk about what's happened?
Well, at the FCC this week, as you described, the commission voted along party lines, three Republicans voting in favor, two voting in opposition, to eliminate the main studio rule. This rule from about 80 years ago saying that a local TV or radio station needs to have its studio, its primary studio, in or near the community it serves. And that served a number of purposes, not only for the community to be able to interact with that station, but also tethering that station to the community in which it's reporting the news and delivering some value to the people who watch it. That rule has been eliminated. And then, as we saw in the clip that you just showed, the chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, a Republican, former staffer to Jeff Sessions, now the attorney general, has said that there is a whole bunch more deregulation in the works. This comes in a year since President Trump's inauguration in January, in which the FCC has consistently knocked down one barrier after another to enabling a massive deal frenzy, a consolidation in the broadcast business, which is exactly what companies like Sinclair want going forward, so that they can gobble up as many TV stations around the country as they can and basically dominate the local news business.
Well, Andy, before we get to Sinclair Broadcasting, I wanted to ask you about the context of this attempt, or in fact, the overturning of the main studio rule. It's been in effect, as you said, for several decades. Has any other administration attempted to overturn it?
No, the rule has been tweaked over time on several occasions to, what they say, modernize it. But the substance of the rule, having that studio in the community where the viewers, where the people who depend on that TV or radio station is, that has not changed over time. And the supporters of the rule say there's a very clear reason for that. Yes, it's true that with email and with social media, you can send a message to your TV station. But the rule also gave that sense of locality. It gave that connection in the news gathering and in the connection to a community that is so vital to local news. And that has been a bedrock of broadcast television for nearly 80 years and has gone unchallenged under Republican administrations and under Democratic administrations. And now under President Trump and with Commissioner Pai at the FCC, that rule is ancient history.
Well, Andy, before, could you explain, because as a result of overturning this rule, all of these different stations, TV stations and radio stations can be increasingly consolidated. Now, one of the companies under which these stations have been consolidated is Sinclair Broadcasting. But this media organization, very few people know about. So could you tell us about this this broadcasting channel?
Yeah, I like to say that Sinclair Broadcast Group is the most influential media organization that most Americans have never heard of. It owns or operates nearly 200 local TV stations around the country. It has a tremendous influence over the local news business, and it marries that influence, that size, reaching into 40% of households right now, with a unabashed conservative and pro-Trump agenda. You see that in the kind of programming that Sinclair produces and sends out to its local stations. These are called must-run segments. They take basically a shamelessly pro-Trump message, repeating talking points of the administration's through its commentators and putting that into the local news. And as you mentioned earlier, Sinclair is eyeing a deal to acquire 42 news stations around the country, giving it a reach to almost three quarters of American households. So this is a massive broadcast company set to get even bigger, and it has a distinct conservative viewpoint that it is intent and bent on projecting out to the millions of people who watch its television channels.
Explain what you mean when you say intent and bent on. Your headline of your piece, Ready for Trump TV, inside Sinclair Broadcasting's plot to take over your local news. What are the edicts being handed down?
Well, Sinclair is a pioneer in what's known as the must-run segment. This is a segment that is produced by Sinclair's corporate headquarters here in the D.C. area and also in Maryland that it produces, and then it sends out to its stations around the country, again, almost 200 of them, and says, you are required to run this 90-second commentary or this two-minute editorial. That content that is being distributed out around the country has a very clear, unequivocal, conservative, partisan bent to it, and frankly, a pro-Trump bent to it. You know, the lead political analyst, if you could call it that, at Sinclair is a man named Boris Epstein, former Trump campaign aide and a former Trump White House aide who left the administration and immediately went into this role at Sinclair. His segments are called Bottom Line with Boris. They are distributed and they are required to run every day at Sinclair stations. And these are basically Trump talking points. And you mean you can go on YouTube, you can watch all of his clips in a row. They are 100% towing the Trump line. And if they're not that, they're softball interviews with Trump administration officials.
Well, I mean, of course, people might know who Boris Epstein is because during the campaign, he was one of his spokespeople, always interviewed on TV. This is one of Boris Epstein's recent commentaries.
It is important to note that voter fraud goes beyond stealing or miscounting ballots. Intentionally improper voter registration is absolutely a type of voter fraud. The Commission on Election Integrity has gotten to work. The extent of voter fraud in our elections has been hotly debated between the left and the right. The President's Commission has been established to come up with a factual, impartial answer to that question. The state should do everything within their power to cooperate with the Commission. And that's the bottom line.
And that is required by every station to run, Andy Kroll?
That's correct. Yes, that's right.
This is another clip from a Sinclair station featuring former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka. The show was broadcast earlier this month.
You do not make legislation out of outliers. Our big issue is black African gun crime against black Africans. It is a tragedy. Go to Chicago. Go to the cities run by Democrats for 40 years. Black young men are murdering each other by the bushel.
By the bushel. That's former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka referring to black African crime on black African crime, saying black men are killing each other by the bushel. Andy Kroll.
Sebastian Gorka, of course, another alumnus of the Trump White House who, upon leaving, went immediately to Sinclair and is now a talking head at Sinclair. So you see this trend of Trump officials going to Sinclair Broadcast Group and then them being put on the airwaves and either pushing a completely crazy message that Sebastian Gorka just did on a segment that was supposed to be about guns in America.
I mean, I think outright racist is a very more accurate way to describe it.
Yeah, it's hard to find the words to describe what that was. You have Boris Epstein as well. his segment that we just listened to is basically advocacy for the Trump administration in its deeply flawed, inept, supposed commission on investigating voter fraud, which, of course, in most cases doesn't exist. So you have this message and you have stations around the country that in a lot of cases just want to do local news. But as they come under the Sinclair umbrella, they are being told by headquarters, you will run these segments. In Boris Epstein's case, Sinclair doubled down and tripled the number of times that Boris Epstein was required to be run by its stations. And so this is the progression we're seeing this year. So we're only seeing a more pro-Trump message at the same time that Sinclair is looking to gobble up more stations and consolidate its control.
Well, could you talk, Andy, about the founder of Sinclair Broadcasting Group, David Smith?
Yeah, David Smith is a media mogul with an incredible amount of sway over what goes on in the local airwaves. He's not well known on the level of, say, a Rupert Murdoch, for instance, even though the two men would, I think, consider themselves contemporaries or competitors. David Smith built a small family company that had three TV stations starting in the mid-80s. They were based out of Baltimore. And he, by finding ways around the law and taking advantage of ways that the law was changed, in this case deregulated, in the past few decades, he has grown Sinclair into this conservative TV behemoth that it is today, and one that stands to get even bigger if the Tribune Media merger goes through. David Smith, longtime donor to mostly Republicans, though Democrats as well, who are in a position to help his company. And today, you know, he throws a party for a Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas. He travels in a, you know, elite, rarefied group of Republican supporters. He's even bragged about dining at the White House with the president. So he is right at the top of a Republican industry donor pyramid, if you will. But he has managed to avoid the amount of attention that, say, a Rupert Murdoch or some other international media moguls that we do have attracted.
And the merging of Sinclair and Tribune. I mean, these are the smaller local stations that dot the United States, you know, crisscross the United States.
That's right. The deal would give, again, 42 television stations from Sinclair, from Tribune into Sinclair. It would add more of those dots on the map. As you mentioned right now, Sinclair has no presence in Colorado. This would give it a major presence in Colorado. But it would also bring stations in the three largest media markets in the country into the Sinclair company: New York, WPIX, KTLA in Los Angeles, and WGN, one of the most famous broadcast companies in America, in Chicago. So this would really seal Sinclair's position as the sort of dominant broadcast company. And of course, given that many more tens of millions of people who would be potentially seeing Boris Epstein, Sebastian Gorka, potentially Bill O'Reilly.
Now, when we were talking about Sebastian Gorka, just to understand, as he's talking about Black African violence here in the United States, who he is, the whole controversy around him wearing that pin at the inauguration of the Vitenzi Rend, the newspaper, The Forward, reporting members of the Vitenzi Rend elite order confirmed Gorka took a lifelong oath of loyalty to the Hungarian far right wing group listed by the U.S. State Department as having been under the direction of the Nazi government of Germany during World War II. I mean, just the significance of what is being required by these local stations to run all over the country.
Yeah, and Gorka is, if you watch that clip or the roundtable that that clip comes from, which is available on Sinclair's website, I mean, Sebastian Gorka is more or less given an open mic to say what he thinks about, in this case, quote unquote, guns in America. We see where he took that theme, but he was a foreign policy aide in the Trump White House. He was not a domestic policy expert. He was not someone working on the issue of guns, for all that we know. And yet he is just given this platform, as he has been on several other occasions with Sinclair, the company seems to have no qualms, given the background that you described, the fantastic reporting that The Forward has done on his past. They seem to have no problem giving him that platform, just as they reportedly seem to be considering an arrangement with Bill O'Reilly, someone who, as you mentioned, has settled sexual harassment claims for tens of millions of dollars when he was at Fox News, to the point that Fox fired him.
Well, explain that last part. What do you understand is the state of these negotiations? And have they been stopped by this latest news of his $32 million settlement with a Fox host for sexual harassment?
What I've heard and what I've seen reported in the past week is that there are negotiations underway between Sinclair and O'Reilly around either whether it would be bringing him in as a host or a commentator or some kind of arrangement or partnership between O'Reilly having his own, potentially his own program, his own platform, and Sinclair as the megaphone, if you will, projecting that program, projecting O'Reilly out using its empire of stations. Now, Sinclair has denied that it is talking with O'Reilly and has repeatedly done that, though the reporting that doesn't go for the official comment from Sinclair would suggest otherwise. I will say that I, you know, talk to people in and around Sinclair, and among the rank and file, if you will, there is kind of shock and disgust that in light of O'Reilly's sexual harassment settlements and all the allegations at Fox, that Sinclair would be thinking about considering a partnership with him. Has a lot of people there upset, concerned about their futures, whether they want to work there if Bill O'Reilly joins the company in some capacity.
Well, Andy Kroll, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly link to your piece. Andy Kroll, senior reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, where he's written extensively about the FCC and Sinclair Broadcasting. His piece published this week will link to Ready for Trump TV, Inside Sinclair Broadcasting's Plot to Take Over Your Local News. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, an undocumented teenager in detention in Texas prevails over the Trump administration. She finally this week gets the abortion she has been seeking for weeks. Stay with us.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see.
On a clear day, you can see forever by actor and singer Robert Guillaume. Robert Guillaume was the first black actor to win an Emmy for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series in 1979 for his character Benson Du Bois, a butler for a white family in the show Soap. Robert Guillaume died at 89 on Tuesday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
An undocumented teenager at the center of a lawsuit with the Trump administration over her right to have an abortion has finally obtained the procedure she wanted. The 17-year-old is detained in a refugee resettlement shelter and had the abortion on Wednesday after a U.S. appeals court ruled in her favor. The teen is referred to in court documents as Jane Doe. The Trump administration spent a month trying to stop her from accessing an abortion. Her lawyer says the staff at the refugee shelter in Brownsville, Texas, forced the girl to call her abusive parents to tell them about her pregnancy, despite the fact that her parents allegedly beat the girl's older sister until she miscarried for getting pregnant out of wedlock. The lawyer also says the staff retaliated against the girl after learning about her plans to have an abortion, limiting her time with other kids at the shelter, and allegedly repeatedly asking her what she planned to name the baby. In an interview with HBO's Vice News Wednesday night, Jane Doe described when she decided to have an abortion.
When I first arrived at the shelter, I decided to do it because I don't feel capable of being a mature woman or being strong or old enough to be able to take care of it. And I don't feel sure about having a child.
Jane Doe also issued a statement via her guardian saying, quote, "While the government provides for most of my needs at the shelter, they have not allowed me to leave to get an abortion. Instead, they made me see a doctor that tried to convince me not to abort and to look at sonograms. People I don't even know are trying to make me change my mind. I made my decision, and that's between me and God. Through all of this, I have never changed my mind."
The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit on behalf of Jane Doe against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and its Office of Refugee Resettlement, which oversees facilities for unaccompanied and undocumented minors who enter the United States. We're joined by two guests. In New York here, Jennifer Dalvin is with us, director of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project, one of the attorneys representing Jane Doe. And joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada, Susan Hayes, legal director of Jane's Due Process, a legal referral service for minors facing unintended pregnancy in Texas. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jennifer Dalvin, let's begin with you. Lay out the suit and what took place this week.
Well, as you said, Jane came here without her parents looking for a better life. She was in a shelter where she learned she was pregnant. From the very beginning, she said she wanted an abortion. With the help of lawyers from Jane's Due Process, she went to a Texas court, and she got judicial permission to get an abortion. But since then, every step of the way, the Trump administration has stood to block her from exercising her decision. Instead of taking her to her appointments, what they've done is taken her to a religious crisis pregnancy center where folks tried to stop her, convince her not to have an abortion, force her to look at sonograms, and they would not let her go to her procedure. For a month now, they were trying to stop her from getting the procedure she wanted.
And what's the law in Texas for others, people who are not undocumented? In other words, do people who are minors seeking an abortion face similar obstacles or no?
They do. They do. Texas requires that teenagers get the consent of their parents. And most kids do that. But unfortunately, we know that some young women can't go to their parents. And so folks like the folks at Jane's Due Process help young women like that go to court. And the Constitution requires you to be able to go to court and get a judicial waiver of that
requirement. And explain how the courts played out.
The courts played out, so she got she got judicial permission, and then we went to court after court, and the government would not back down. At every step, the court said, yes, this is a constitutional right that she has, but the government kept appealing and appealing until we were finally able to get her the procedure she needed.
Susan Hayes, describe who Jane Doe is. You know, obviously not giving her name, but talk to us about a young, undocumented teenager in detention in Texas.
Jane is like hundreds of other girls who come up from Latin America seeking a better life. A significant percentage of them are sexually assaulted on the way. Jane's Due Process has been working with them for many years now. Anytime one of these Janes, as we call them, are in detention and choose to have an abortion, we help her, working with local lawyers, file out her judicial bypass and get that court order who gives her not only the right to consent to her abortion, but also the right to do so without anyone notifying her parent or legal guardian that she is pregnant or has ever desired an abortion. And it was that first order that she got all the way back on September 25th that the Office of Refugee Resettlement ordered the shelter not to honor and to hold her hostage and not allow her to go to her abortion appointment back in September.
Well, I want to ask you about the person who heads the Office of Refugee Resettlement, Scott Lloyd. Could you tell us about him and how he figures in what's happened in Jane Doe's case?
The abrupt change of the practices of the Office of Refugee Resettlement go back to Scott Lloyd hitting that office sometime in March of this year. And he is using that office to inflict his personal religious beliefs on unaccompanied minors all across the country. And you simply cannot do that under the First Amendment. The government doesn't get to pick a side in a religious fight. And an individual cannot constitutionally use government power and government money to do that.
And how does he play in here? Talk about the significance of his position in the Trump administration.
The Office of Refugee Settlement is a part of the Health and Human Services Department. It is not a position that's subject to Senate confirmation. President Trump appointed Scott Lloyd to that position in late March. However, in the emails that ACLU's obtained through their litigation, his name shows up in early March as part of a new, what I'll call a double-top secret informal policy of no one gets an abortion in ORR care without Scott Lloyd's permission, and the shelters, more importantly, were ordered not to do anything to help any minor who wanted an abortion take steps toward that, such as complying with state laws by seeking a judicial bypass order. Scott Lloyd has also done things like fly to Texas to go to shelters to personally minister, talk to, cajole pregnant, unaccompanied minors, and presumably on the government dime. It's highly unusual for the head of an agency to act that way and be so personally involved in individual cases and personally directing individual cases to the outcome that he wants, not the outcome that is right for that Jane.
Jennifer, how common is this Jane?
Unfortunately, it's all too common. As Susan said, when young women come to this country searching for a better life, they are often subject to sexual assault. There may be hundreds of pregnant young women every year. And so although yesterday Jane was able to get her procedure, it's incredibly important that people not think that this is over. This is Scott Lloyd's policy, and it applies to all the Janes, and we'll continue fighting until we get this policy knocked down.
Well, she has had, Jane Doe has had the abortion now, but you've said justice for Jane also means immigration relief. Could you explain what you think should happen?
That's exactly right. So yesterday was a victory for Jane, but only in part. Jane is still in a government shelter, and so are, you know, thousands and thousands of other people in this country. And so yesterday we breathed a small sigh of relief, but there is still tremendous work to be done, both on the access to reproductive health care and on the immigration side.
I wanted to ask Susan Hayes about how the George W. Bush administration changed who legally has custody of an unaccompanied minor and what you understand the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, the now disgraced Tom Price, has to do with that.
Well, back in the George W. Bush administration, the legal custody of these minors was held by the shelters, and that meant under state judicial bypass laws, shelter staff could consent to an abortion. Back toward the end of his second administration, there was an incident in Virginia where some shelter staff did consent to an abortion in a shelter affiliated with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, as you might expect, threw a fit, and the George W. Bush administration changed that designation of legal custody so that ORR itself has legal custody, that is, bureaucrats in Washington, instead of the social workers and staff on the ground in these shelters who care for these children. The net effect of that is kids in shelters have to go through the judicial bypass process, which is kind of hard to get to a courthouse and file a case when you're in a shelter. You have to have the help of someone on the outside to do that. And I've done these cases for 17 years now. At the time, I remember really hating that policy as being unfair and a burden on these unaccompanied minors who choose abortion. Flash forward to now with Scott Lloyd, that very policy that George W. Bush put into place in 2008, Scott Lloyd is now violating because it's very specific that you must follow state law. Here, this Jane Doe got that judicial bypass order with the help of Jane's due process and her court-appointed attorney and guardian ad litem on the ground there in the Rio Grande Valley. And the Office of Refugee Resettlement defied that court order and ignored it.
We have to leave it there.
Thus violating their own policy that goes back to 2008.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. That's Susan Hayes, legal director of Jane's Due Process. And also thank you to Jennifer Dalvin of the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project. Nermeen Sheikh and Juan Gonzalez will be speaking tonight at the Philadelphia Free Library, and Juan will be at Seattle on Friday night. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.